This is Batgirl, and you're listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 225 of The Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me, as usual, is the Comic Concierge. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. We're recording this after a Labor Day weekend, not to date the record too much, I guess. But so we're on a Wednesday here. I don't know if it feels more like a Tuesday or a Thursday. I'm lost. I don't know what's going on in the world. We ordered a piece of furniture that was supposed to come Friday, which was going to work out fairly well because I have a pretty easy schedule Friday. And it showed up today. And no. I don't know why I opened it and started it, but I did. And that ended up taking a long time. When you get a box that has parts, you know, like the hardware, like all of the screws and stuff like that, and they're labeled, right? Like they usually have like a number or letter system or something. So these were lettered, and it got to the point where certain parts were double A, like we've gone through the alphabet and now we're on to AA. And that's too many parts. When you get all the way through Z and you have to start doing the double up lettering, like I feel like I didn't sign up for that, but it's together. It's looking good and it's over. Now I have a lot of catching up to do from work I should have got done today. So how are you doing though after your holiday weekend and as we get ready to record another in our Cary Grant series?
So you mentioned furniture. I guess I don't know why Labor Day is furniture weekend, but a lot of sales. So we got ourselves some new couches and it's been way too long. It's been like 15 years since I got a new couch. And the technology has changed a great deal since the last time I got a couch. I'm like, there's like, you know, phone chargers and the couches and things like that. I'm like, this is crazy. It's like, I just need a couch. I don't need like a complete entertainment system within the couch. I would like one, but I'm lucky.
Hopefully you didn't have to put it together though.
No, you're getting it delivered soon. That's funny you say that though, because like we're telling our kids when we're getting it. It's like, oh, so we're gonna have to put it together. I'm like, no, this is furniture we finally don't have to put together ourselves. We're just used to getting stuff from IKEA and things like that. Because we just got a big thing for trying to sort out their Legos. So that was crazy. But outside of that, you know, just getting ready for football season. I think by the time people hear this, it's probably kicking off. Giants probably have lost like 3 games already, even though it's only like week 2. But that's how they're that good.
They'll find a way.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious. So we are back at it, like I said, to talk a little bit more of Cary Grant as we get to another movie in his filmography. And it's going to be interesting here on the reactions, I think, that we have to this one. But before we get into our actual thoughts, let's have Dan go ahead and lay the groundwork on the ins and outs of the 1941 film Penny Serenade. Take it away, Dan.
And now for something completely different. This week, we are discussing Penny Serenade, released in 1941, directed by George Stevens, starring Cary Grant and Irene Dunne. In the film, Julie Gardner, played by Dunne, is preparing to leave her husband Roger Adams, played by Grant, and listens to old photograph records that trigger memories of a life together. She recalls their whirlwind courtship, marriage, and move to Japan, where a tragic earthquake causes her to lose her pregnancy and learn she cannot have children. Back in the U.S., the couple adopts a baby girl, Trina, who becomes their joy. They experience the ups and downs of parenthood, but when tragedy strikes yet again, it looks to separate them in a way they cannot recover from. Cary Grant received his first Academy Award nomination for Best Actor for this film. Many critics still consider his courtroom plea to keep his adopted daughter one of his most powerful dramatic moments of his career. He lost to Gary Cooper's portrayal of Sergeant York at the 14th Academy Awards. Irene Dunne and Cary Grant were frequent co-stars. This was their third film together, After the Awful Truth in 1937 and My Favorite Wife in 1940. Both screwball comedies, unlike those, Penny Serenade was given a chance to be a straight drama. This film uses records as a storytelling device. Each song Julie plays triggers a flashback. This was a creative structure at the time and tied directly to the title Penny Serenade, referencing cheap records. So how well do those techniques stand to the test of times years later? Does Cary Grant truly pull off a performance worthy of an Oscar nomination? Back to Kevin and myself to discuss.
All right. Thank you for that. Dan, as always, does a great job of setting the stage for us. So I'm going to have one comment and then I'm going to have a question and kind of throw it to you, Dan. So my one comment is I'm very thankful that we did this in chronological order and that we did not watch Penny Serenade after bringing up Baby, because I feel like that would have been whiplash that my old body would not have been able to recover from. as far as two different ends of the spectrum. So the question I have for you is, I think a lot of, like, Penny Serenade is not a film that has a lot of name recognition these days, I feel like, especially probably outside of movie lovers and film Twitter and Letterboxd accounts and stuff like that. I feel like the common person doesn't know or has probably not heard of Penny Serenade. I feel like it's one of those that's kind of been forgotten over the years. It doesn't have the name recognition of a lot of the films that we watched in the Hitchcock series, even the ones that we've watched so far, like The Philadelphia Story and His Girl Friday and things like that. Whether people have watched those or not, I feel like they still know the name. So it seems like it's kind of been lost to time in a way. On the other hand, though, this is one of Cary Grant's only award nomination for best actor films. He only got nominated, I believe, twice, and this is one of them. It's also, according to what we've read on him, this is perhaps his best performance in his mind, according to comments that he's made in interviews. It's also Irene Dunne's one of, if not her favorite films as well. So my question to you, Dan, is, did we get it right with letting Penny Serenade kind of be lost to time, or do we need to take up the mantle? Is it our mission, Dan, yourself and me, to bring Penny Serenade back into the forefront of modern movie discourse? What was your reaction to Penny Serenade?
I'll be honest, like, I was not emotionally ready for this movie. As you mentioned, the last movie we did being The Philadelphia Story, which was comedic, had some drama, but it was melodrama. It wasn't really high-stakes drama. Pretty much every Cary Grant movie we've had has been, like, either thrilling with the Hitchcock films or heavily comedic. And going into this, I purposely just tried to know nothing about it. I didn't, like, watch the trailer, read anything. I just, like, let's go in blind, see what it's like. I know he was nominated for an Oscar, so I'm like, oh, it's probably a bit more serious, you know, or it's maybe, who knows, maybe it was really good. I didn't know why. So we're going through it, and like, okay, it's clearly a romance film, and it's really heavy on that. So it must be that type of story. Oh, they're going to get divorced, so it must just be them trying to fall back in love with one another. I was not expecting this to go the places it did. You know, we're in Japan, they're getting ready to have a baby, and then suddenly an earthquake. I'm like, oh, wow, this is serious. And then, like, starting to put things together of what's really happening and what this could lead to. I was like, wow, I was not expecting a movie of this ilk, of this time, to, like, get into things like miscarriages. It doesn't, like, directly mention that or even say that word, but it's clearly what happens. And and the law, you know, that the pain of that. And then, you know, it starts to kind of, you know, see them go through the adoption process and everything like that. I'm like, okay. At least we're seeing, at least this is coming on the other side of this and being a bit more happy. And then suddenly we start reading a note. And I'm like, wait. At first I was like, I wasn't going to read the note along with it. I was just, okay, let's go. And then I'm realizing, okay, they really want me to read this. I'm like, wait, hold up now. That's awful. Like, this has gotten even worse. So I just wasn't, like, emotionally prepared for it. Not necessarily a bad way, but I was not expecting this type of level. And I do think speaking of Cary Grant, like, he is really good in this, and it is a different version of what we used to. We do get some of those comedic bits. We do see him, you know, especially when they're, like, first having the baby, and you know, there's some funny moments there, and seeing him go from this reluctant father to, like, really caring for this child was something, and the performances, you know, Irene Dunne, as you mentioned, she's really good as well. I think they have strong chemistry, and I don't know, I thought this was a much stronger film, obviously much more dramatic, and I thought they all kind of worked well. I like the editing choices, utilizing music to kind of pick out certain moments within their life and how it relates. I thought that was a clever and effective way, even like how it's like edited scene to scene. So I thought, you know, it was not the most pleasant, laughing, you know, entertaining watch. Perhaps like the ending was, I had issues with that, and we can get into it. But I can think that's just part of the code that they were living under, as we mentioned a lot with the Philadelphia story, which is probably why they had to kind of get that type of ending. But beyond that, I don't know. I thought this was, I do think this deserves to be talked about much more, even if you're not just talking about the quality of it, just the willingness to talk about a certain subject matter that, I don't know, even films today struggle with. So how about yourself?
So before I get into my thoughts, I would just like to know, or like to state for the record, that whoever, so we've been watching Cary Grant, he, like you said, he's had a lot of comedic stuff that we've, you know, obviously some of the Hitchcock stuff is a little bit more thriller and suspense, but we still get North by Northwest, in which he's funny. We still get his comedic bits, even in the thriller type genre. And then we go in and have Bringing Up Baby and His Girl Friday, which are, you know, just ridiculous comedies. Not ridiculous in a bad way, but just like, you know, full on comedies. And whoever made the film poster for this film, it says Penny Serenade. It says the director's name. It says the two stars' names. Irene Dunne gets first billing, by the way. And the quote on the poster is, "There's the love we all dream of finding," which grammatically does not make sense. But anyways, it's there. And it's like a picture of the two of them. And it looks like it's a party sequence. They're, you know, Cary Grant's giving us a wink. Irene Dunne seems like she's celebrating. Who made this poster? This is the most misleading nonsense I've ever seen in my life. There was maybe one sequence in there where they were enjoying themselves and having a good time. Yeah. That was it. But man, two things that kind of stand out in my head for this one that were kind of more very minor notes in my watching of this, but I've thought about them more as I've kind of been digesting where I land on this film. One of which was, I was actually watching this film, I believe on Labor Day. I know it was a day that I wasn't working. And sometimes I watch movies like later at night when everybody else is sleeping or different things. And it's, you know, it's not always like a full house or whatever. I was actually out in the living room this time watching this film. This film is from 1941. It is black and white. It has music from, you know, the 1920s, 30s, etc. And not necessarily the most accessible for like children or people of this generation. Sometimes people don't like black and white films. Sometimes people, you know, don't like that style of music, et cetera, et cetera. I'm watching this out in the living room, and, you know, I see probably the first third of it, first 20, 30 minutes of it by myself. By the end of the film, my wife is watching it. My five-year-old is watching it. And it struck me that it roped both of them in. And like, they were even asking questions about what, you know, my wife was asking me questions about what she had missed, try to catch up. Like, she was invested in it. And like, my daughter was watching it. Like, she was just following along real good too. And I'm just like, what is it about this film that is like getting their attention and bringing them in? But it has to be something, right? Otherwise they would just walk out and go do something else and go play with toys or, you know, go in the pool or whatever they would do. So I thought that was kind of interesting. The other thing that I thought it did, which was somewhat subtle, I guess, or I don't even know if it was intended, but the part that they had not seen is the beginning part where we get to the point where we know that Irene Dunne's character, Julie, is in this apartment, and we know that stuff has not turned out well. Like, that's given away fairly early on in a conversation she has with the best named character possibly in film history, Applejack Carney. So she has a conversation with Applejack, and you know that they have alluded to the fact that this isn't, this relationship didn't work out. In our heads, that's what we're told. You know, like that's our perception, is something has happened along the way that this relationship has not worked out, that there is no children. Like, that's they tell that, like, we pick up on that. That's communicated to us in the beginning. And then we go through, like Dan said, the sequence of playing these records and kind of going down memory lane and reliving memories of her past. And we get to see the blossoming of their relationship and things like that. So when my family came in, they hadn't seen that first part, so they don't know how things are going to end. And in my head, I know something has to happen that's going to derail this. And it added like a bit of suspense almost that I wasn't expecting from something that is so serious and so dramatic as what we're getting. I was literally on the edge of my seat at one point. This movie is 84 years old, so I don't think there's any need to like kind of put the disclaimer out for spoilers, but there's a sequence that happens at a school play, and I'm seeing that my wife and my daughter have been like sucked into this movie, and I know something terrible is going to happen, and I'm convinced that it's going to happen at this school play, and like,
oh, no.
There's a misstep, and I'm like, my heart is in my like throat. I'm like, oh my goodness, like, do I need to tell my daughter to like leave the room?
Yeah,
and it's totally a misdirection because nothing happens there necessarily that is that bad, and it obviously happens in a completely different sequence that we read about later. But it was like, I was like, wow, like I was actually like on the edge of my seat, like buying into the suspense of this moment because I know something bad is going to happen and yeah. I don't know how or when, but I know that other shoe is going to drop. So like, I was surprised at that amount of almost suspense that was built in at the same point. Like, I guess we can't get suspense away from Cary Grant, but were you in the same situation where you know something bad is going to happen, but you weren't sure exactly how or when it was going to happen?
I definitely, that sequence, I did think something was going to happen, just the way it was taking its time so much. I'm like, what is, because, you know, it was, she's walking really slowly, they're, you know, going, carrying, you know, she's moving this little cloud, which one, I thought that, like, that stage design, super clever. It was like, oh, wow, that's actually really nice. Like, that's pretty well done. And I'm like, okay, is something gonna like happen here? Like, you do get that, and then she falls down, and then oh, it actually ends up being fine. So yeah, I think a little bit within that sequence, because you know, there's a lot of movie left,
right?
You're just wondering, even if it wasn't like something like harm coming, just like something messing up, like a fight or something like negative. Like, we knew something was going to happen to lead to them,
mm-hmm.
you know, potentially having this divorce. So,
well, and I thought it was somewhat obvious at the beginning that there was no, I thought one of the comments that she makes to Applejack implies that there is no child anymore.
There may have, I completely, by that point, it slipped my mind completely.
Maybe I just read into it, but I was convinced that this child that we're watching and growing to love in this situation
is
not going to end well for us. And I was like, oh my goodness. But it kind of goes back to another thing you were saying too. Like, it's, I know some people would claim that it's like unrealistic, when I've heard this critique before on different movies where they see like negative happen upon negative thing happen, and they almost try to throw a flag that says like, well, it's unrealistic. Nobody's been through like that many bad things in a row, which I always have a problem with, because that literally is how life happens for some folks. Like, and you know, we have this situation where we have the earthquake, right? So we have the miscarriage. We have the first attempt at trying to go to the adoption agency and looks like it's not going to go well, right? Like, they're getting read the riot act. Like, you have a very small percent chance. It's going to take years, et cetera. So we have that. Then we have what happens, you know, with their first child, and, or first, then the court's going to take the child away. right? Like, so it's like, and then something happens to the child, and then the relationship breaks down. So it's like, you know, we're into like the fifth or sixth traumatic event that's happened between this couple, and it is a lot to stomach, but I never thought it was necessarily like unrealistic. I was, you know, along for the ride and thinking like, this is very much a tale that could have happened to an actual couple. So I didn't see that as an issue with it, like being piled upon it, but it is something that you have to be like emotionally ready to take in as a viewer. Just like the time after time where you're like, oh, it's going well. No, it's not. And it's like, it does that like three times. But did you think it was too much at any point? Or did you kind of feel like it was natural the way that it progresses from like one traumatic event to the other?
I thought it was naturally done, because it's not like every event is a bad event. Like, we get some moments of hope in Glee, and that ultimately that Christmas pageant sequence is a very pleasant one. It's a, you know, it's a very nice and quaint scene, and we get a lot of that. And I think the adoption stuff was also, it felt very realistic to me, and maybe a little bit, you know, over dramatized, of course, for a film, but that having to go through all those, if anything, it's made it a lot easier than it sometimes is, because it skipped over a bunch of stuff. But I never felt it was overbearing with kind of these things happening. You know, you have the earthquake, the ramifications for that. You have, of course, him starting a paper, and everything seemed like it had reasoning behind it. Like him losing his job, it made sense. Like, because, you know, he was starting up a newspaper, kind of doing it without really being prepared to make that type of decision. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we did get moments of them together, happy, having those moments where it's like, okay, you could see why they would stay together. Why, you know, I'd liked his progression of at first, like going to see this baby. It's like, well, go see if you want. I'm not that interested in it. It's a girl, so why do I care? And then that changing around, that to me was probably at least the most joyous sequence, them trying to learn how to be parents. And I felt those struggles were very realistically handled, where you don't you feel like you're over your head. You don't know how to do anything. I'm glad I lived in an era where diapers weren't that hard to put on, because
I would have been screwed.
Yeah, where you have to like fold it and put it, and I'm like, man, I'm glad we just had the things on the side, and that was it, and we were good to go, because I could understand those frustrations. So I felt nothing felt overblown. Like didn't feel like melodramatic or like a soap opera. Like I said, the ending or the death of the child certainly felt like it did kind of come out of nowhere, but in a sense that's kind of how it would happen. Like, I don't know that in, you know, kids that age during that era, it wasn't super uncalled for or uncommon, you know, illnesses, and, you know, luckily we have things called vaccines, unless you're in Florida, that we can utilize and to help prevent that type of stuff now. So I don't know, I never felt like it went through emotions in the sense of just like, let's make you sad again and do it again, and let's do it in really unrealistic and overbearing fashion, where like my goal here is to make you sad. Where you know, there are movies like that, I can't think of anything on the top of my head, where it's like, oh, there's like endless sadness, and it's like, why am I watching this?
Right.
I didn't get that feeling watching this.
No, and I think you bring up a good point. I think it was very cool to see Cary Grant's performance as transformative, as far as going from someone that was probably not even interested in having kids to someone that wanted a boy to someone that's putting up with the, you know, his love to kind of appease her, and then like seeing him like gradually fall in love with, you know, the girl, and et cetera. I thought he played that off fairly well. Another thing I wanted to get your opinion of, this is obviously somewhat of a limited cast. I know we go to different places. We kind of have at the beginning, there is a few more people involved as they're kind of going through their, I guess, the courting phase or things of that nature. But for the most part, we're dealing with the main two characters here in Julie and Roger. We have their friend Applejack. We have the adoption. I don't know what her official title is, but Miss Oliver, we're just going to say the head of the adoption agency. And it's really like those four, and then the twins that play the child at different times. I think there's two different sets of twins. One is the newborn and one is the youngster because of how many rules they had back in the day of hour restrictions. So in order to do it, I believe they decided to cast twins so they can get twice as much filming done as they otherwise would have. But outside of that, I mean, you do have a judge that appears very briefly. You have her friend when she's younger, but they kind of are very minor parts. You basically have like four adults and then this child. How do you think they handled that as we kind of jumped into the different moments of their life? Like, did you appreciate that we were just kind of limited to just a few characters? And how do you feel like the side characters of Miss Oliver and Applejack played into that? And did you enjoy their performances?
I didn't even notice that there was that like that short of a cast, because I feel like with a lot of movies we've done so far, that's kind of been the case. You know, the Philadelphia Story was mainly like, I guess, you know, five or six people with, I guess you could say, a little bit of cast. His Girl Friday, of course, had a lot of extras, but the main characters were just a few. So it didn't even cross my mind until you brought it up, but that definitely makes sense. I thought that the cast overall was strong. I think Applejack, like, legitimately was such a great, like, we all need a friend like Applejack, because, like, the guy just, like, had the folksy wisdom and, you know, coming in to save the day. Like, he always was able to kind of say that, and like, that all shucks attitude. Like, I could, like, if we had an Applejack spinoff, I would be the first person to watch that movie. I really liked his character. But, yeah, I thought overall the cast was strong. The child actors were pretty good. You know, I think they told their part well, and even like the babies, you know, they use them. The fact that they use actual babies and not like,
right,
just dolls. But I, speaking of being stressed out, when they brought the baby into the bed, I was like, oh no. I was like, oh no, is this how it, like, is there something going to happen here? Cause like, you know, in right. So it's like, who knows? But also,
you got to appreciate their makeshift crib that they made too.
Yeah. Also, very real feeling where, like, you go to find, you know, and they're gone. You're like, what? You're just always worried about the baby, or right. Like going, like, is it breathing? Just make sure it's like, that's, yeah, we've all been there. So, but no, I thought the cast was overall strong. How about yourself?
I did too. And I did some reading up, and I thought I found a couple of interesting tidbits. The girl that plays the toddler version of the child, like the 6-year-old or however old she is, 7-year-old, whatever. The name of that character is Ava Lee Cooney, and she actually played she was an extra in The Wizard of Oz to fill in the Munchkin scenes.
Oh, wow.
Because they didn't have enough of, what's the proper term?
Little people?
Yes, they didn't have enough little people, so they used some kids to kind of fill in the scenes, and she was one of them, so I found that was kind of interesting. Very short filmography. I think she was only in like 10 films, but she did go on to dance as a dancer in Vegas, I think. And I think she performed with like Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra and stuff like that. So quite the career from her, and from a couple of different angles. And Edgar Buchanan, who plays Applejack, had an extensive both film and television career. He like tons and tons of credits, but look at like the kind of stuff that he was in. The Partridge Family, he appeared in there. He appeared as the same character in both the Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres. I didn't know there was crossover characters unless they both just had the same name, Uncle Joe Carson, in both of them. And he, if you go through his filmography, it's almost all as either judges, doctors, or uncles. He plays...
So he does have that type of atmosphere around him. Like, he does feel like the fun uncle, or like the uncle you'd go to if you had issues.
And I didn't know that there was this like multiverse in the TV world, because he plays the same exact character in three different shows. So he played Uncle Joe Carson in 222 episodes of Petticoat Junction, in three episodes of The Beverly Hillbillies, and in 16 episodes of Green Acres. Same character. So I didn't know those shows were connected at all. So now I need to like go do some research.
Yeah. But
he also played an uncle in Leave It to Beaver, Uncle Billy Cleaver. He was in Dennis the Menace. He appeared in the Andy Griffith Show. Like, he was in like the Bonanza, the Rifleman, Maverick, like every show that was famous back in the day, he appears like in some way, and a lot of Western stuff as well. Especially when it came to like the movies, he was in quite a few Westerns towards the end of his career as well. So he has an impressive filmography, I'll say that much. And Beulah Bondi, who plays Miss Oliver, the adoption agency representative. She was born in 1888. I think that's interesting. She also got an Emmy Award for a guest star role in The Waltons. And get this, she played the mother of Jimmy Stewart in 4 different films.
Interesting.
Including Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and including It's a Wonderful Life. So 4 different times she played Jimmy Stewart's mom. Like, that's a crazy tidbit of trivia that I thought was interesting.
Yeah, so, I did not know that. That is...
Yeah, so so quite the cast that got to do a whole bunch of stuff in their career, for sure. And obviously we know Irene Dunne and Cary Grant are, you know, Hollywood icons from that time period of, what do they call it, the golden age of Hollywood. So we don't need to get into theirs too much. But Dan, I wanted to get one more time your, I know you said you kind of enjoyed how the music played throughout, and I know they were very conscientious of having songs that fit the time periods that they were depicting and that matched up with songs that could have been heard in that time period. What did you think of the actual editing with the records being put on and then us going to the center of the record and going into the scene and then kind of going in and out of that? I think they did that maybe like at least 6 times.
Yeah.
How did you feel like that as far as the transition effect?
I thought it was effective in the sense of it allowed it so you were able to kind of jump around in a way that made sense, and you kind of understood that you're getting snippets of their life, but also you understood like the importance of music and how that connects us. I also think it works in the sense of like often the way memories work, because often, you know, I'm an auditory learner, so like that is often like how hearing certain music or even listening to certain things like that triggers memories for me. So I thought that was a good use of that. And then, you know, the overall editing of just the look of it, I thought it was a little shaky at times. Also, I don't know if that was like just the version I was watching, because I know this entered the public domain, so there's a lot of like shaky and not great versions of it. Like this, I watched it on Prime, so I don't know. But it wasn't, overall, I thought it was well done, and it was able to, it made it easy to follow in the way it was segmented, and it made it the transitions from one scene to the next all make sense. It was varied enough. Plus, I was surprised that they actually used the real Happy Birthday song, because that
you
know, was one of the most expensive songs ever to use until like it just went into public domain like 2 years ago. So like they spent a lot of money using that song. So I was like, oh wow, they're going all out here. And how did it work for you?
I thought at first I was a little bit nervous about the number of times they were going to be doing it potentially. And I didn't like, at first I didn't know if it was just going to happen once. And then you kind of get the feeling that it's going to happen a few times. And then obviously it happens, you know, like I said, almost a half a dozen times. So I was somewhat worried that it was going to grate on me over time, but I actually did appreciate it, because like you, I'm someone that definitely had, you know, a certain song plays and it takes me right back to a certain time in my life. So I totally get how it's working with her and how she would want to put a few more on and which memories that's going to conjure. So I thought it worked well enough for I guess a unique way to transition between sequences that I had never seen before, so I at least appreciated that part of it for sure. Another question I had for you, Dan, and then I'll get some of your kind of final thoughts as we start to wrap this up, but I know some people have issues with what they call exposition dumps, where we have like a certain time where everybody is catching us up with a plot or, you know, a monologue that's more to like advance storylines and stuff like that. We, in a way, get something here with that, with this letter that is written from Julie to Miss Oliver, kind of explaining some of the stuff that has happened and advances some things that events that happened in their life. I don't know if part of that is done to get around some of the codes and the censors of the time. I haven't studied those for, you know, thoroughly to know what they could and could not show. What did you think about that? Because I know when you were talking about it in the beginning, when we have text on screen, a lot of times we have to choose whether we're going to like pause it and try to read it or read it with it or not read it and just see if we need to or not. What did you think of the execution of that sequence and kind of what it does to progress the plot and the use of a letter to do that?
It's an interesting choice. Like I mentioned, when it first came on, I just thought it was like, oh, here's a letter to this person, to kind of thanking them for allowing us to have this child. and everything. I'm like, oh, okay, that's sweet. And, you know, so I wasn't really that, like, okay, let me take time to read this. I wasn't really, you know, paying that much attention to it. But then it, like, it stayed with it. And then I think we, like, turn the page and there's, like, more to it. And I'm like, oh, this is clearly important. I should read this. And then as it's going on, I'm like, it kind of hit me. And I do wonder, like you mentioned, is it just part of the censorship at the time? Because I'm certain, like, it was limited in being able to show, like, a children. They couldn't obviously show a child dying on screen like that, I would assume. So it's one way of being able to do it. It's like, okay, we need this to happen. This is the choice we have. It caught me off guard. And it kind of puts you in the shoes of that character. So I don't know. It also, like you mentioned, it is a lot at once. And it's like, okay, here's a big, huge event that we're going to just show you through, like, text on a screen, which is not always, not always the most visually appealing way of telling a story in the movie sense. So, you know, on one hand, it's one of those things where I understand it more so than found it, like, the right choice.
Right, yeah, it's like one that maybe this is not the best way to do this, but I also am not educated enough to know how much their hands were tied on what they could and couldn't do, so it's like maybe this was their creative way to do this. I know it even said, one of the trivia bits in the show said that they were surprised that they could even, apparently they couldn't even at this time show two adults sharing a bed.
Yeah.
And they do show that in this film. So there was, like, some questions as to how they got away with even doing that. And I think there isn't they allude to the fact that they have had, you know, sexual relations at one point, and that was a big no-no. So, like, it's hard to put yourself in that time and know what could and couldn't be done, I guess, during the Hays Code and different things of that nature. So anything else that you wanted to bring up about Penny Serenade that you liked, disliked, or final thoughts that you haven't been able to share yet?
The thing I wanted to talk about is that ending where it seems like they, and we talked about this, like, during that was something with the code. If you got divorced, if you brought up divorce, then they had to get together by the end. So I knew that was happening, but also just the choice of, like, oh, but we found you another kid. and it's, like it's a dog or something. It's just that ending is just like, that's a little gross. And again, I get, like, that of the time, but, like, that's, to me, if you're, like, looking at the biggest issue with the movie, it is trying to solve that problem. So, like, what if you just, you know, they don't have a kid and they have to work through it? And I get, like, that probably wasn't an option for them, even if they wanted to go that way. But it just also just feels a little icky where it's like, oh, we can not have to worry about the kid we lost because we can replace them. And it just,
right.
It's a.
My wife definitely had a reaction to that. She was so they're just going to replace them with another one. Got it. And I think the other problematic part about that is it doesn't give, like, we're to believe that this has completely devastated this relationship between these two adults. Yeah. Like, they're not speaking hardly, they're not hardly able to be in the same room, it's destroyed the love that they had, all this other stuff. And then, like, one quick note about, like, hey, they found a boy, and it's like a light switch and all of a sudden they're cool with each other. I was like, that's a little too tidy.
And I get, like, part of that is it's the time period. And but also there's a lot of issues there that they're glossing over, because I clearly went through it, and it doesn't necessarily address a lot of the problems that were lingering. But that was also, you know, a society issue at the time as well. So I think it's hard to, like, blame the movie for that when society wasn't quite there yet as well. But
I felt bad for Applejack, because he's got to move everything back in, and, like, he's just going to do it because he's a nice friend. And
justice for Applejack, because he did so much. He gets yelled at for, you know, making the paper because it's making noise in the beat. You know,
like, he was going ham on that thing, though.
Yeah, he was. He was going. True.
I love Applejack. He's definitely going to be in the running for best supporting character when we get done with this Cary Grant retrospective. So coming up next after Penny's Serenade, we're going to jump a couple years into the future. Going to go from, I believe, 1941 to 1944, where Cary Grant actually does a pair of films. So we're going to cover two films from 1944. And the first of those films is going to be a film called Arsenic and Old Lace. So we're going to go from slapstick, you know, comedy in the beginning to super serious in Penny's Serenade. And now we're going to go right back to comedy with Arsenic and Old Lace. Dan, what is your history or knowledge of this next one we're going to cover?
So this one I have a pretty good history and knowledge of. I've seen it before. Also, in high school, we read the play, and like we acted it out in like our English classroom. And for some reason, it's always stuck with me. I played the role of Teddy, the guy who was like the guy who thought he was Teddy Roosevelt. And then later on, watched the movie in high school and watched it again probably like 7 or 8 years ago. And I was a big fan of it then, so curious if that all remains the same. But at that time, that was like probably the only Cary Grant movie I saw, or one of the few. So I'm interested to see, like, now watching all these movies, like, how does it compare with all that? So looking forward to it. How about yourself?
I think this is the first time in a while that we're actually going to go into a film that we've both seen before.
Okay.
So that's going to be interesting. So, and it's a very oddly similar story. So we had a community theater, I guess you can call it, that in the beginning, all it was it basically went from the school producing a play once a year that the students did. And then it turned into like a community theater that would host kind of a school play, but then would also do their own plays throughout the rest of the year. And it was just like a small community theater. And so we would have one of the productions every year would be the school one, and the rest would just be community people or from people from around, you know, the different communities neighboring us and stuff like that. And when I was a junior, I want to say, in high school, they came to us and, you know, the idea of this next school play, it was one of the first ones they were doing at that time, and a bunch of my friends and I were like, hey, you know, like, why not? Like, let's do this. And so this is the play that they put on, was Arsenic and Old Lace. And I actually got to play Jonathan Brewster in this play. So I was the villain, one of the two villains, I guess you can call it, in this play. So anyways, I didn't know anything about acting or anything about what this was going to be like. So, you know, I know some people say don't watch the source material and some people say do. I don't know. I was like 16 or 17. So I went and got the movie and was like, I need to see like what this is. I have no clue what this is otherwise. And I'll just be kind of going in blind. So I watched the film at that point. And then obviously we did the play, and I don't know, I think there was maybe like 8 or 9 productions of it that we had to do. So, or shows. So I definitely got very familiar with it. Obviously we did our own take on it, and there was some ideas that were added and different things. So it's going to be hard for me to separate like what was ingrained in me versus what actually happens in the movie, because we, you know, emphasize different things as you're going to do with a live play. So it's very interesting. We both have like a background of not only seeing the movie, but, you know, being involved with the play itself. So I remember one of the things that struck me about the play was that, you know, this was like 1998, 99. I know I'm dating myself, but we're talking about the late 80s or the late 90s, I mean. And what struck me was that something from 1944 still came across and played as funny as it did when we did this for both ourselves as like teenagers doing it. We thought it was funny. And like, obviously the audience thought it was funny and stuff like that. So like, it was funny to me that something that old, like in my young mind at that point, I didn't associate humor translating like that. So it was like somewhat of an eye-opening thing that was like, oh, you know, even stuff from other time periods that you may not think would still hold up can be just as funny as anything you've seen nowadays. So I appreciate the humor in this one a lot. So I'm looking forward. I haven't seen the film though since then. So it's been 25 years since I've seen it. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. And, you know, at the time I didn't know I was watching, you know, Cary Grant and et cetera. So it's definitely going to be interesting on this rewatch, and I'm looking forward to it. So, all right, Dan, why don't you tell people how they can stay in touch with you, or if they have questions or comments, how they can get them to you?
Just search Comic Concierge on all social media platforms, and you'll find me there.
All right. You can search us out on all the social media platforms, Letterboxd, things of that nature. If you want to keep up with our film thoughts and opinions, definitely search us out on Letterboxd. You can also get to me on X or Twitter or whatever you call it, at Optimus Solo. You can find the show if you search out the Cinema Geeks, or you can search out the website at Geekcast Radio Network to find out all things that we've done. And if you're just joining us recently just for this Cary Grant retrospective, then we encourage you to also go back and join us as we went through quite a few, I think 15 of the Alfred Hitchcock films as well, and we can have a good time talking about those as well. So that does it for this episode. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more of the Cinema Geeks.